The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. And David, today our guest, Yehuda Avner, he'll be on here in just a moment. You know, there's a crisis brewing in the Middle East. You know, there has been for decades. And just this week, if you look at it, Iran had reported that they have sensed a nuclear submarine in the Strait of Hormuz. Of course, we've got this Turkish shipment that's causing diplomatic problems coming down to resupply Gaza. Give us a little bit of a perspective as to why we're covering what we are today, David.
Well, we've looked pointedly at the issue of Iran in recent weeks, and we'll be traveling to the region in a matter of days. Can we understand the events of our day in a broader historical context? Can we appreciate the struggles faced in the region? We repeatedly narrow the focus of our curiosity to appreciate the granular nature of an issue, whether it's a financial or political issue specifically. And then sometimes, Kevin, we broaden the perspective to make sure that we are sensitive to the larger context.
Well, today I think we get to do both, don't we?
Exactly. Honing in on specific issues as well as setting a broader context. Today's discussion and a series of questions which we'll pursue in coming weeks as we meet with government officials, as we spend time in the Knesset, and firsthand seek to understand the crisis and the opportunities brewing in the Middle East.
Wouldn't you say, though, David, an understanding of a little bit of history helps a person form a context for current events?
Sure. Jewish history and an appreciation for the hardships endured in the creation of the State of Israel were a part of my upbringing. I've traveled to Israel a half a dozen times since I was a young boy. Nearly 15 years ago, I left Oxford and between terms spent 6 weeks in Jerusalem. We read a combination of French and Jewish literature, and for me, it was a question of discovering the history of the people in that place. I walked for hours each day the streets and got to know it in a very intimate way and spent hours discussing ideas and events and issues over shared meals.
Well, and you know, that's come to the forefront this week as you've been reading the Prime Minister's, Yehuda Avner's book. It's been a great way of appreciating Jewish history since 1947.
Well, in recent days, Kevin, I've discovered something gripping, and it is a unique view into the internal world of the State of Israel. I've just captured a glimpse into the strengths and weaknesses of the leaders that have marked the last 5 to 6 decades of recent Jewish history. Getting an insider's view from a diplomat, from a statesman, from a witness who has seen and heard and been present firsthand for the vast majority of the critical events in that land from 1948 to the present. And I'd say, Kevin, that few, if any, could pen a narrative on Israeli leadership as informative as the one Yehuda Avner's written. For any person familiar with or with interest in the making of the modern Middle East, you will have to add this to your library. As you mentioned, Kevin, it's called The Prime Minister's. It's a collection of notes and reflections gathered by a man that aided and advised every administration from the inception of the State of Israel to recent times.
Well, you know, the thing that made this difficult, David, was we just received the book 48 hours ago, and you're already 500 pages through 700 pages of the work. And, you know, it's not available here in the United States yet.
And it will be September 1st. Kevin, what I've known growing up with a sense of Jewish history, what I've known has come alive to me in new ways. As history and as certainly the style of this book in narrative form has been interwoven into a really remarkable testament. And in the Jewish tradition, the responsibilities of a witness are greater than those of a judge. If the testimony is true, as it's been said, the verdict will be just. And his characters, the characters in the book, each of whom is fairly represented and measured by their own words.
Well, you've
and
got
actions.
Menachem Begin, Golda Meir, you know.
Zbigniew Brzezinski, Samuel Lewis, Henry Kissinger, LBJ here in the United States, Richard Nixon,
Shimon Peres,
Moshe Dayan. It is the who's who of the Israeli state, and also international players who've had a major impact, some positive, some negative, in the early informative years.
And it's from personal interaction, personal witness, not necessarily somebody who's just reading history themselves and rewriting it.
Yeah, Kevin, as you mentioned, there's only one disappointment you'll have to endure. And if you want to read the book, you'll have to order your copy this fall. It's not available here in the U.S. market until September 1st, although it's already on the bestseller lists in Israel. So it'll be released this fall, and I'm sure that many of you will be first in line to order a copy after today's discussion.
Well, you know, David, I know he focuses particularly on the four prime ministers that he served with, and, you know, that was an area of focus on the book.
Well, particularly insightful were the diplomatic choices and the crisis events addressed uniquely by each of the four prime ministers featured in the book. You get to see much of the thought process that went into things like the Six-Day War and Yom Kippur, the preemptive strike in Iraq of the Isiric nuclear facility. Those processes, those, shall we say, marks of leadership that linger even today in the Knesset, and I think they're worth reviewing in detail in light of the tensions brewing in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
Well, welcome, Mr. Avner. Can you set a context for us? The State of Israel in the 21st century, there are several current events I'd like to discuss, but before we do, perhaps you can reflect on what has been accomplished in the last 62 years and what remains at stake for Israel today.
I think it has accomplished a revolution in terms of Jewish history. One can say that since the destruction of the temple in 70 AD, until May the 14th, 1948, when the State of Israel was resurrected, we Jews are the people that have always been the object of history. People were always making the decisions for us. As of 1948, we resumed again, after 20 centuries, becoming a subject of history, whereby we are now responsible for our own decisions, and we have the means to make those decisions. That is, in my mind, the ultimate transformation that has changed the whole face of the narrative of the Jewish people from the mid-20th century onwards.
Well, so the historic conflict which continues to exist, maybe you can set a framework for us in terms of international relations. How have international relations with Israel changed in recent years and affected or necessitated a different regional disposition?
Well, I think a shadow, a very dark shadow, has been cast upon our whole region and is in danger of changing the whole balance of power in the region, and that is with the emergence of Iran, with its ambitions of becoming a nuclear power. Our region is divided into two major parts: the Sunni Arabs, who represent the majority, and the Shiite Arabs, minority. And here, Iran, which is a Shiite state, which has ambitions to dominate the whole of the Middle East, has got the Sunni Arabs into such a nervous twitter. Very quietly, they are in contact with Israel. Little Israel, I have to say, because we represent just a sliver of territory on the eastern seaboard of the Mediterranean Sea. We are hardly 6 million, and we are surrounded by over 300 million Arabs, a figure population larger than that of the United States. A land mass of 22 Arab states from the Persian Gulf to the Atlantic Ocean. Again, a land mass larger than the United States. And divided as they are, and I'm speaking here in the broad sweep between the Sunni and the Shiites, for all the shrill headlines that might be made concerning the antagonisms of the Arab population generally towards Israel, there is today, very discreet, I don't use the word liaisons, but I would use a word of abstract expression. I would call it an expression of creative ambiguity between ourselves and the Sunnis vis-a-vis the threat of Shiite Iran.
Rabin's idea of the two concentric circles surrounding Israel.
Yes.
Who is the greater threat, Hamas and Hezbollah or Iran?
When you're speaking about Hamas and Hezbollah, you're speaking about Iran, because both of them are proxies of Iran. They are armed by Iran. They lets me take the orders from Iran. And so you have Hezbollah, Iran proxy within Lebanon, adjacent to our border. Hence, Lebanon does not enjoy authentic integrity of sovereign independence. And you have on our southern border, along the Gaza Strip, you have Hamas, which is forsworn to destroy, and I use that word in the most literal sense, to destroy the Jewish sovereignty of the state of Israel. Nevertheless, our determined strength through our defense forces have evidently sobered both Hezbollah and Hamas in terms of the fact that for the last few years, except for intermittent violations, those two fronts, our Lebanese front and our Gaza front, have been relatively quiet.
Now, we have in the news presently Turkish shipment en route to Gaza, and our curiosity is just how does this drive U.S. foreign policy? Does it change our foreign policy as it relates to a supportive posture for Israel?
I presume you're talking about this so-called international flotilla.
Correct.
Which is on route to Gaza. They are, when I say an international flotilla, this is a group of pro-Palestinians from different elements in Europe, and I use the word flotilla in a miniature sense, in the sense that these are small boats. Obviously, they're trying to make a propaganda point. They are allegedly carrying human assistance to Gaza. I anticipate that these boats will be accosted while they're still at sea. Once they enter into territorial waters, they will be tugged to one of our ports, probably Ashkelon. There, the cargoes will be inspected to make sure that they do not include any kinds of arms or weaponry of any kind. If not, they will be loaded onto Israeli trucks, and then Israeli trucks will track these cargoes to Gaza. The people involved will probably be sent back from where they came from.
The last few weeks have been most curious for the outside observer of certain Middle Eastern issues. In Israel, 5 days of nationwide missile and rocket test drills, civil defense practice, that's been initiated. We've got the joint Greek-Israeli naval and air exercises beginning in early June.
Yes.
We have Syria, which has put its air force on high alert, and Hezbollah has moved thousands of militia to the south of Lebanon on a full war footing. Most recently, we've got Russian President Medvedev, who's agreed to the Damascus request of rapid deployment of Russian anti-aircraft missiles. This was in May. And at the same time, we have our chairman of Senate Foreign Relations, John Kerry. He's in Damascus meeting with President Bashar Assad, while the Lebanese prime minister was earlier this week behind closed doors at the White House with President Barack Obama. Now, reading your book, I realize this may be just another day in the life of an Israeli diplomat. But
well said. Well said in the sense that nothing fundamental has changed from day one to the present day. As a matter of fact, as I was putting my last lines to my manuscript, this is a thought that floated through my mind. And the French say, plus the France, plus my même chose, the more things change, the more they stay the same. The issues have hardly changed at all in all these 60-odd years of the conflict. Nevertheless, you mentioned Turkey. Turkey was given by us a very positive script in terms of the conflict, and it has seemingly ripped up that script. Turkey to us will seem to be the bridge between ourselves and the Arab world. It seems to have turned itself its back now, not only on us, but on Europe. Turkey wanted to become a member of the European Union. Evidently, the European Union is not happy with the thought of such a massive Muslim population joining such a union. So Turkey seems to have aligned itself now with Iran and Syria. And that is a great disappointment. I should imagine it is a great disappointment to the Obama administration itself. As for the Obama administration, the president from the very outset declared a strategy of engagement with the Muslim world, and you might recall about 4 months ago, he flew to Cairo and delivered an address to the Muslim world in order to bring about a grand historic reconciliation between the West and the Muslim world. Well, one of the things that he had heard that the Muslim world would exhibit some confidence-building measures towards Israel in order to facilitate, lubricate the peace process. Nothing has happened. President Obama, a man is a man. He has to be disappointed at that fact. He even tried engagement with Iran. Again, Iran has simply scoffed at the idea, turned to Turkey and Brazil in order to fabricate some kind of a diffusion of the nuclear crisis. That diffusion itself seems by any account to be full of holes. It's more of a propaganda gesture than anything else. And he's been trying to create this, as you mentioned, engagement with Syria. Syria too is aligned with Iran. Would but that all these engagement efforts would bear some form of fruit. I'm afraid that in certain senses, sections of the Arab world, they interpret this not as American strength, but as American weakness. This is how things are in our part of the world.
So what you're describing is the strategy of engagement wherein we have tried to be reconciling, in fact, that is not viewed as a positive step, but as a sign of weakness in the context of the Middle East?
This is what I am saying. I'm basing myself not simply on speculation, but on first-hand knowledge. I don't want to go to the other extreme and say the only language that they understand is force. That is not so. But a strong America, an assertive America in terms of the promotion of its own ideals and values, which are the values and ideals of Israel, means they are a source of strength to Israel as well, and a source of encouragement to those moderate elements of the Arab world who seek accommodations. The opposite is also true. And the Obama administration, they started off with us very much on the left foot by seemingly placing upon us responsibilities to make all kinds of gestures that would encourage a dialogue. At the same time, expecting on the Arab side similar kind of gestures for the same purpose. Well, the Bibi Netanyahu, our prime minister administration, has taken all kinds of gestures and has been met on the other side with an attitude of whereby let the Americans snatch the chestnuts out of the fire for them. Now, what I mean by that is this. You can't make peace by incantation, by nice words. And we've heard some brilliant, brilliant speeches over the months. And by the same token, you can't make peace by not sitting down with your neighbor and hammering out the details of what a peace contract should look like, whereby each side puts whatever demands and claims on the table, and in the end, they reach some kind of a compromise and agreement. And for this, the United States' assistance as an honest broker is indispensable. Now, instead of that, direct negotiations with our Palestinian neighbors, which we've had in the past. In the past, we are now engaged in a peculiar exercise, which is called proximity talks. And proximity talks is that you have an American mediator, Mr. George Mitchell, who is jockeying between Jerusalem and Ramallah. We're not even under the same roof. And I am not alone in thinking that these talks of themselves are just going to get nowhere. As a matter of fact, it's just going to confound possible understandings that we had had in the past when we had indeed have direct negotiations. So those who hope that these so-called proximity talks will be a very short corridor towards direct negotiations, I hope they're right. Because if you listen to what the other side are saying, I have many Arab friends and we've known each other for years and we talk. And the attitude is, let the Americans do the negotiations for us in these proximity talks. We're not talking to you, we're talking to the Americans. And that is not a prescription for the establishment of mutual understandings.
Once again, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com.
We have Iran and their move to develop nuclear capability, which has added dimension of stress to the region. The three things that are necessary for a serious nuclear threat are largely there: fissile material, a delivery system, and the technology to improve that fissile material to a weapons grade.
Correct.
Is there a sense within the state of Israel that they must be proactive, with the understanding that there are ramifications, massive ramifications, if they were to pursue actions like that of ASIRIC?
But the last thing that we would want is a proactivism of a kind which you are alluding to. You're alluding to military action. And yes, the ramifications, they would be enormous. At the same time, we're dealing here with an Iranian government under Ahmadinejad, but in my view, they're playing their hand brilliantly, in the sense that all that they're doing is to buy time. The Iranians are superb negotiators, in the sense that, remember, this is a nation that invented chess. They have centuries and centuries of experience with a shrewdness that sometimes finds the loopholes in the diplomatic enterprises of those who have naive beliefs that through human communications you're able to bring out the best in people. In diplomacy, this is not the case. You have to have the hardware to back up your diplomatic action. Otherwise, you're toothless, you're a paper tiger. And therefore, there is this expression, nothing is taken off the table. Well, I do hope that nothing is being taken off the table. Because in the meantime, the Iranians have been doing extremely well, I would even say brilliantly, in buying time. This latest exercise with Brazil and Turkey is buying more time. There are certain red lines that if those red lines are crossed, there's going to be a conflagration here in the Middle East, the like of which the world has not seen before. And this all ties in with what I was saying in the beginning between the Sunnis and the Shiites, and the very quiet liaisons that are taking place within the Sunnis and Western powers, and I'm not excluding ourselves from the term Western powers, to do something to stop Iran. And within Iran itself, there's a great deal of nervousness within the people. The sanctions, the whole of the notion of crippling sanctions. We're still waiting for these crippling sanctions. I say this with a degree of skepticism, because if you're going to try to go through the United Nations so-called crippling sanctions, then you're dealing with a body that never, ever, in recent memory, has it ever taken any thing of a decisive nature against that part of the world which, because of a quirk of geology, sits on the largest energy reservoir in the world. Nations have their interests which take precedence over collective interests. So these are some of the complexities. We are there right on the front line. And so this last week, we've had, as you mentioned, we've had emergency civilian air raid precaution exercises. Just before you called, I was speaking to a granddaughter of mine who's in our army and who's very much deeply involved in these exercises. And as she was telling me about them, there was something rather sad, that a feeling that overcame me. And that is, right to this kid of 20, 21, she's an officer in our army, why should he at this age have to engage energies, emotions, intellect in this kind of work of the protection of the civilian population of Israel? Because between the last war and future wars, God forbid there should be any. Now that our enemies have got rockets of various ranges, they have the means to seriously hit our civilian populations. At the same token, I cannot recall a time when we have invested so many of our resources in creating defensive means against such rockets. Short range, medium range, long range. We have a defensive rocket called David Sling, which is short for short range to counter short range. We have something called Iron Shield for medium range. We have something called the Arrow for long range. Theoretically, Israel is covered by an umbrella of defensive ground missiles in order to counter, God forbid, any attempt to rain missiles on Israel. So even as I'm describing this to you, I have to tell you, life here in Israel is good. And that's it to say, there's nothing in the Israel streets. It's theaters, it's parks, it's everyday life that would indicate that we have got such vicious enemies on borders with rockets trained at us. But if it should come to it, I suspect that we will abide by a doctrine that was first enunciated by our first Prime Minister, David Ben-Gurion, and that was the task of the Israel Defense Forces when attacked is to carry the battle to the other side.
Well, I look forward to spending some time with you this next week in Jerusalem. As you say, there is a peace and a calm in that city and within the country, in spite of a context which can at times be very stressful. And people go about their business as if there's really no concern, though in their hearts there may be great concern. The ability to, whether it is compartmentalize or just live well in the context of stress, I've always seen as a remarkable characteristic there in Israel.
Thank you very much. You put it well. The thing is, David, once you've read the newspaper, had the headlines over breakfast, you just get on with things. And we've made rather a good job of it, I think, in that our society is growing, is progressing, is developing, and we're at the cutting edge of high technology in every field. And yeah, I'm proud to call myself a Jerusalemite.
We look forward to seeing you there in a few days. As we wrap up our discussion today, are there considerations that in America we have a fairly narrow view of things? Many Americans never even leave the United States, have never traveled internationally. Is there anything that would be helpful for them to better understand or perhaps include in their interpretive grid as they're thinking about the events in the Middle East and how better to understand them, more accurately understand them?
Well, I don't think you and I can think of a better substitute than coming personally themselves and seeing for themselves. The country seems to arouse emotions, and sometimes high emotions, among many people abroad. Maybe it's because of the fact that we're talking about the Holy Land. Maybe it's because of the fact that we're talking about the conflict that has been going on for so long. Maybe it is because of the fact that many people don't understand the elements of our long history. In fact, we Jews are the one people in the Middle East that speaks the same language, tills the same soil, practices the same faith, and bears the same name as our forefathers thousands of years ago. That is the ultimate truth of our self-identity in this land of ours, which I have to say, were but that we had a dialogue of true genuine peace with our neighbors. And I think most of the population would indeed be ready to partition this country between a Jewish state and an Arab state. But, you know, just as a bird cannot fly with one wing, a person cannot applaud with one hand, so neither can a nation make peace without the other side to join in that same goal. And what a blessed goal it would be were it to happen.
Well, Yehuda Avner, thank you so much for your time today. And we look forward to the release of your book, The Prime Ministers, this fall. We'll have that available and see that it's read here in the office as it's a tome with great insight and testament to this last 60-odd years of Jewish history.
Thank you so much indeed. Bye-bye now.
Well, David, what an interesting man and a fascinating interview. I know you're going to be meeting other people next week as you go to Israel to discuss these topics. It's going to be a great trip, I know.
Kevin, we have certainly more questions than answers, and our trip is dedicated to figuring out what is happening in the Middle East and perhaps better understanding some of the complexities, the interrelationships and the international relations, those issues involved between the United States and Israel, between Israel and Palestine, between Israel and Iran. We'll be meeting with the finance minister. We'll be meeting with Yehuda Avner again. And the purpose is, again, to better understand and hopefully bring clarity to our listeners. Yehuda Avner was born in England and spent much of his life, most of his professional career, in service of the State of Israel. As consul in New York, he was counselor at the Washington Embassy. He was ambassador both to Australia and Great Britain, and then was non-resident ambassador to Ireland. He's the speechwriter and secretary and advisor to Prime Ministers Levi Eshkol, Golda Meir, Yitzhak Rabin, Menachem Begin, Shimon Peres. I mean, the reality is, Kevin, that our short interview today and his, I would describe it as short exploration in terms of his experience with these prime ministers, and it is 700 pages, but it's a short read in terms of how fast you want to go through it. Riveting, in my opinion, in terms of the narrative style. This is a person who can add insight, I think, to our understanding of the complexity in this region, and we'll continue to explore it with the same caliber of people in Jerusalem this next week.
Well, David, one of the things that I loved about the book was when I heard the prime ministers, that can either be dry, diplomatic, or it can have a heart. And I mean, I found myself actually starting to weep when I was reading certain portions, or my heart would beat really fast when he was talking about Osirik. He's one of the few people in the room with Begin when the F-16s were flying.
One of a few, one of three.
Yeah.
We're not talking about one of 50. I mean, in terms of knowing ahead of time the things, the struggles, the decisions, the massive life and death situations that the State of Israel and its leadership have been in, he's been there to see the struggle.
Yeah.
And you get a sense for that in the book.
And he loves Israel.
And he
loves the Jewish people. And you can't help but have the same feeling when you read the book.
It makes sense.
Well, you've been listening to the McElvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McElvaney, and our guest today, Yehuda Avner. You can find us at McElvaney.com. That's McElvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McElvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McElvaney Weekly Commentary.